Revenue Committee. Today we're going to review the revenue forecast process, and we have Mr. Pitowski and Mr. Kennedy with us. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I can set the scene just for a minute. The House Interim Revenue Committee, you've got a memo there that's dated January 30th, but the last page of that was, if you turn over, there's a memo from Chair Shetterly on the back of the memo from me. Should have a memo.
I do not have the memo.
I don't either.
Okay.
It's right here. It's on the back side of this one, underneath.
Oh.
There you go. And you turned the page and you came right to the memo.
Thank you, Senator Hannon. Thank you very much for your help.
How does he know? Why?
It's a visually impaired
man. You are old.
But this a memo is in response to a memo on the backside, if you flip over, from Chair Shetterly in October, which directed me to review the forecast process in light of the large downturn we've had and make some recommendations on things that might improve the process and might help the forecasters as we look ahead in the next biennium. So what I've done is review that and then made some recommendations for you. But I think in terms of context, I've asked Tom and Mike to come through and walk through the process they use and answer any questions you have about that process. So we can go there and then come back to my memo.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
So is this the memo that is basically the, Lucy, you got some splaining to do memo?
Well, I think probably all forecasters across the country are going through this, and it's kind of a post-mortem. And of course, the mortem part is also important for what lies ahead in terms of addressing questions about, you know, are we looking at long-term changes versus kind of cyclical changes, and I'm sure that Tom will talk about that.
Tom, okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the Senate Revenue Committee. For the record, my name is Tom Pitowski, State Economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. With me today is Michael Kennedy, Revenue Economist, also with the Office of Economic Analysis. So I'm just going to jump right into this review forecast process. Our objective that we try to do in our office is produce an unbiased forecast of general fund revenues. And by that unbiased aspect, what we mean is an equal likelihood of being over and under actual forecasts. We're really trying to see what we think is the most likely baseline case to occur. And what we're hoping is that over time, because we're forecasting, for example, when we come to this May 15th forecast, which will basically set the close of session amount for the whole two-year period, lots of slips can happen in terms of data, economic events, even legislative changes that can occur. So what we want to be able to do is hit what we think is the most likely outcome, and then the errors that may happen, because they cannot be captured necessarily over that whole two-year period, we hope it's just as likely that those errors would be stronger, more revenues coming in than forecasted, as opposed to less revenues coming in. So that we're really trying to hit a baseline, most likely scenario. So I'll start into this, and Michael will continue into the specifics, giving you some broad overview. There's various general fund forecast components that go in. The major ones, and of course the major, is the personal income tax collections, along with the corporate income tax collections. Our office also directly forecasts the cigarette and tobacco, gift inheritance, interest earnings, and some of the other smaller general fund revenue sources. We also collect some forecasts from some other agencies, including insurance tax, the state court fees, criminal fines and assessments, that other agencies originate and we fold into the forecast. I'll give you a kind of the real broad overview of how Paul would probably say as how we make sausage. And the general overview here is we start with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors at a pre-meeting. These 12 individuals that are in the private sector, although we do have some academics on the committee, these are people from high tech, utilities, forestry, agriculture, retail areas, people that we feel have a good sense of what's happening at the moment out in the Oregon economy. Many times our models can't exactly grab what is happening right at the moment. And through their advice, that helps us to sort of change the model to meet those needs of what they see is happening out in the economy. So we review U.S. economic history and forecast with them, and that goes into the Oregon economic model. National drivers are important in the Oregon economic model. Then we bring in Oregon economic history. We come up with a preliminary economic forecast, both historical data, national data, advice from the Governor's Council. Then we meet once again with two groups. We meet once again with the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. By the way, this is a quarterly meeting. We do a quarterly forecast release. And then we also meet with a DAS Advisory Committee. This is made up of basically clients of our product. The Employment Department, Revenue Department, ODOT, Department of Agriculture, Economic Development, LRO is a member there, the Treasury Department. So quite a cast of characters around from the state that also assist us. We take all that information in. We come up with our final economic forecast, and those lead then into our personal income tax models and also our corporate income tax models. And then Michael will expand out on those two models. That leads then to our overall models based on economic factors. Then we take information, things like legislative impact statements from LRO, fold those into the model, and then finally come up with our final revenue estimates. And as we said, we formally do this on a quarterly basis.
Tom?
Yes?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hannah?
Before you leave that slide, do you have a follow-up graph that perhaps you're going to share with us that uses this format that shows where the Oregon economy went and where your forecasting went to show what the disparity was between the two or the closeness of the two? And the reason I'm asking you this is that I think perhaps all the legislators were somewhat critical of the economic forecast, that we didn't have forewarning of this enough, that it was going to be this severe. But I don't think anyone foresaw the events of 9/11 or the economic ramifications thereafter. And when you show your graph where your projections were where the Oregon economy went, how does it compare to the national trend, where some economists also taken back at the federal level in their projections on where they were headed to, so that your numbers reflect trends that were developing, or was Oregon out here doing something totally different? Do you have any graph that you're going to be able to share with us?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, we have, I think, a few graphs that come very close to directly looking at what you're asking about.
Okay.
We've got some that look at what was to actually happen and what was our errors involved in that forecast, and, for example, what was just a simple trend. What would that have said if you would have just gone with that?
Because I think what we did, we took snapshots rather than looking at the global picture. And if you look at the global picture, it's somewhat different than the individual snapshots that we were given along. Because my sense is that the individual snapshots, while in fact it showed a decline in the revenue, it wasn't projecting out a future reduction of the magnitude that we went to.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, I think that's true. We all knew things were slowing down.
Yeah.
We were taken aback by the severity of what we kept seeing every step along the way.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're going to have some graphs to show us that. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Senator Hannon, I've also, as part of what I've done, is tried to decompose the difference between the May 01 forecast and the current forecast and broke down what are the components that have changed and what is the revenue impact of those components. So that will give you another kind of another breakdown on that question.
Because, Mr. Chairman, I think there was a sense that when we put the last session's budget together, that we knew that there was a slowdown coming, but we couldn't project out the significance or the catastrophic events that led to the dramatic spike in the economy going down to the degree that it was. And so I think a lot of people perhaps maybe criticizing, well, why didn't we have this forewarning? I don't think anyone had that kind of knowledge or crystal ball to say this is what's going to happen out. And perhaps that's one of our difficulties with our models that we use, is we're always trying to project out 2 years in advance. And it's difficult to project out 9 months sometimes.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, my recollection of our release of the May 15th, 2001 forecast is I spent probably the majority of my time defending why the forecast was not too pessimistic.
Uh-huh.
Was not too pessimistic. Oh, I see.
So, Tom, is it possible, and I know this might be somewhat guesswork, to put a percentage figure on 9/11 and how big of an impact with an economy that was already showing some weakening? Can you say 30% of the shortfall that we experienced, the 1.7, was we saw post 9/11?
Mr. Chair, that would be a difficult number to come up with. We know from various factors that there was definitely a great drop in consumer confidence that occurred, although on the other hand it bounced back quite quickly, but then took another tumble when we had the problems with corporate governance and the stock market fall. To the extent that the stock market fall and that hurt our capital gains and thus our capital gains revenues fell, was that because of 9/11 or was it because there was a big financial bubble that had just built up and finally there were corrections that occurred that would have happened no matter what a 9/11 would have been? We do know that with 9/11, if you're certain industries, for example, if you're in Nevada, you didn't do too well after 9/11. Very tourism aspect, where plane destination, Hawaii, for example. But for us, I think it was just the general hit that did occur with us. It hurt us, but percentage-wise, would be very difficult in my mind.
Do you feel comfortable at all? More it's just a curiosity that I have, putting a ballpark, if you were guessing what that figure was, that contributed to the overall shortfall and weakening of our economy.
Well, in retrospect, we saw that we were in recession before 9/11 hit.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was going to be, and everyone had expectations, this is going to be a very short, very, you know, if it is a recession, it's going to be one of the mildest recessions ever on record. To the extent that 9/11 changed that view, made it deeper, then I would say, you know, you're looking at maybe 20% of our problems might have been related to that. But I would almost say the economy most likely, regardless of 9/11, we would have seen still the recession mm-hmm. to occur.
Mm-hmm.
And have Michael get into the specific models here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Michael Kennedy with the Office of Economic Analysis. I'm going to give some fairly high-level looks at these two models, the personal and corporate income tax models. There are more detailed methodology reviews available in hard copy. And starting with the personal income tax model, given that that's roughly 90% of our general fund revenues, we give this the most attention. And very generally speaking, this is the system that we're trying to model and then project with general economic conditions, then beget Oregonian taxable income. That then, via tax laws, creates a tax liability, and then at some point, the state of Oregon will receive those dollars. And so that's the general flow and what we try to model. This is a general schematic of the process we undergo and the components there. You can see there are a number of components to the general or the personal income tax forecast. And at each of these points, there's a considerable amount of data that feeds into the model to derive the final quarterly collections forecast. As you can see there, we get data from Department of Revenue in terms of actual data. We get national data via our consultant, which is Global Insights, formerly DRI WEFA. Those feed into our economic model, the Oregon economic model, and produce employment and personal income. Our own professional experience as econometricians, a whole variety of information feeding in each of these points. And in general, and I'll go through the steps we take, but it basically boils down to modeling and forecasting liability, Oregonians' tax liability. That's basically the core center of this, and then that eventually is translated into dollars we will eventually receive as collections. So in terms of the actual steps, one of the first things we do, we have a model that projects the number of Oregonians in two different types of filer classes, single and joint, and then by level of income. So this is our income distribution model. And in order to do that, we employ variables like employment, income, other economic indicators such as interest rates, market equity values, that basically determine what Oregonians' income will look like and what our distribution of income will be. We forecast those out. Currently, we're forecasting out to tax year 2009. We provide those forecasts then to the Legislative Revenue Office, who maintain the tax calculator. And what it does is look at those various representative classes and estimate what their tax liability will be, using a sample of tax returns for each of those classes, and then generating an average liability for those income classes and filer types. You sum that up and you have a total liability estimate for each tax year. And this is also important because they use the tax calculator to develop estimates of tax law changes. So because you have the detail there about what say deductions these filers have, what their income looks like, they also estimate things such as the delay of Measure 88. And so that's an important component here. They deliver back to us the total liability forecast, and then the question is, when will those dollars come in the door? One issue here is that there is the fact that 10% of filers in Oregon pay about 80% of the personal income tax. So what you have there is a concentration of people with the greatest tax liability, so that small differences in the number of people you're forecasting at those upper brackets make a huge difference in how much liability you're forecasting. So with that potential error there, we've developed a companion forecast that's more aggregated, where we just look at taxable income over time and liability, and make another forecast that just looks at effective tax rates and how those relationships have been over time. We take and compare those two. Where they're similar, that gives us pretty good confidence about the number. Where they're different, that tells us we need to go in and do some more analysis to try and understand what's going on. Is it a problem with the income distribution model? Is there something wrong with our companion model? But it gives us an idea that we need to do further analysis.
Mike, what's the bottom income to get you in that 10% that pays 80? Do you know?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to say right now, for joint, I know for a fact it's about $90,000. That's gross income.
For joint, it's 90.
Right. And in fact, I can go back and figure that out more exactly.
Do you know it's not that important. Do you know ballpark what individual would be?
I should.
Keep mentioning ballpark, Mr. Chair.
I agree, Mr.
Subconscious.
Well, the next one, somebody call my name.
Sorry, I didn't mean to wake you up, Senator Adams.
Mr. Chair, I think it's maybe one of our gross income brackets below, so either 70 or 80.
70
it's someone a little below the joint.
Right.
And eventually we then employ our judgment in the two and come up with a final liability forecast for each of the tax years beyond what we have in history. And then our task is to translate that into when we are going to get the money here with the state. And so we look at historically both the distribution of liability as it comes into the state withholding and estimated payments, which are the prospective payments on liability throughout the year, plus the final reconciliation at tax time where you have final payments and or refunds. And then we also shift those dollars out to when they're historically tend to be received. In fact, the following graph gives an illustration of that. This is the 2001 tax year. And so you can see there, withholding tends to be about 86% of eventual liability. Estimated payments are another 18%. Well, that's about 104% of actual liability. That's because Oregonians in general tend to overpay during the year and then receive a net refund on whole come tax time. Roughly a 4% net outflow of dollars come April and May, roughly. And then you can also see the timing there of the various components. And so that's used to translate that liability forecast into a collections forecast. And then we look at that collections forecast and we look for any anomalies, anything out of the blue, or like Tom was saying, any recent information we have that's not factored into the model to make final adjustments. We also include any tax law changes that come out of Legislative Revenue Office and produce our final collections forecast, which graphically looks something like this. You can see there's both some volatility there, but there's also a fair amount of seasonality. The corporate income tax model is similar in the sense that it begins with corporate tax liability. And that, in this model, is modeled on national corporate profits, which is a variable we receive from Global Insights as part of our contract with them. And we apportion that to Oregon using the ratio of Oregon to U.S. personal income, which has been a fairly decent measure. And we modeled then corporate tax liability on those variables. And then similarly, the issue is when are we going to receive the money here at the state? And a similar process is used. We both have to then say what kind of how that's going to be distributed by payment type, advance, final, and or refunds, and when are the dollars going to be received. And so a similar graph here shows the timing of that. The only complication here is that corporations do not have a standardized tax year like individuals do. They can basically pick any fiscal year they want. And so there's tends to be a longer period of time at which tax liability for a given tax year comes into the state and a little less consistency. But in general terms, it's the same process. We have a collections forecast initial, then we look for any problems or anomalies, things that are a little suspect, make some add factors for those, and incorporate these legislative changes, and again, produce a quarterly tax collections forecast. which, as you can see historically there, has far more volatility than the personal income tax.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hannon.
Where does the substantial loss in revenue for the electronics and Intel, where does that show on your graph there? Does that show a decline in payments?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, I think right in here you can see, following about mid-2001, a definite drop in the advance payments, the green,
okay,
right about here. Plus, you can also see a major pickup in the volume of refunds as they experienced losses.
So was the kicker refund in place during that time, too?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, at this time, there was not a corporate kicker.
Just a personal kicker.
There was just a personal kicker.
Mm-hmm. So, Senator Hannon, last time we had a corporate kicker was following the 95-97 biennium.
95-97.
Mm-hmm.
So this is showing the refunds that corporations were getting off the loss of their revenue or their business income.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, correct. What tended to happen there is they went along paying about what they're used to in retrospect, and then came to the end of their tax years and realized things had gotten a lot worse, we're taking a lot greater deductions, and we were hit fairly unexpectedly, particularly right there at the beginning of fiscal year 2001 and then 2002, much higher refunds than ever in history.
Because there was a time during one of the special sessions when I think Tom gave an economic forecast, and the quarterly report for corporations during that period had fallen substantially. If I recall, something like $72 million in a quarter.
Easily.
It was pretty steep decline. And so that was reflected in 2002 up there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, yes, I think that's the second deep spike there.
Okay, thanks.
And in fact, the reason that was worse is you can see along the same time you had that first deep spike, you still had considerable advance payments coming in the door.
Mm-hmm.
It barely offset. But those drop off, whereas the refunds continued. It's the second spike, I think, that was the major outflow. And we do that quarterly, obviously every 2 years. The May 15th forecast is produced, and then incorporated into that are any legislative actions during the session to produce the close of session forecast that's published with the September publication and sets then the baseline against which the kicker calculation is made. So that, in brief, is the methodology for the two major components of our general fund forecast. What we'd like to do now is kind of look at the historical performance of that forecast. And just starting off with a general background, this shows the percent change from biennium to biennium of general fund revenues. And as you can see, there's considerable difference from year to year, from biennium to biennium. The average here over this two-decade period has been about 13.5%. per biennium, but with as high as 22% there and as low this biennium of negative 7%.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hannon.
Using that figure that you just had up there on that graph, in the governor's recommended budget for 2003-2005, was it predicated on the minus 7%, or was it predicated on a steeper reduction, possibly in 2003-05? Because what you show up there is 2001-03, and so the governor's projected budget, is it based upon that minus 7, or is it based upon a minus 10 or 12.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, we do have a forecast for 0305 that I'm going to get to actually in a little bit. That is, it's based upon the economic variables, our economic forecast, driving to a revenue forecast. The number is actually about 13.5% above the current Binance level.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannon, these numbers here, and then the 0103, of course, we haven't finished with this biennium. Uh-huh. This is based on the December forecast, and that is the forecast that the governor has used for his recommended budget.
Okay. I was just wondering if he was using that minus 7 as a driver for his budget recommendations, or was there a steeper number that was being contemplated?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, it is that number, because that is the one from the December forecast, and we then translate that number into our forecast for 0305.
Okay.
And so it's our 0305 forecast from the December release that the governor uses.
Okay, thanks.
So in terms of actually looking at the forecast performance, we did a couple things here. We first of all looked and said, okay, 13.5% has been the average growth rate from biennium to biennium. Take that as your baseline. You could derive a very naive, very simplistic forecasting process just by taking the actuals from one biennium and ramping them up at that 13.5% level. And what this graph does is say, take that very naive methodology, also take our close of session forecasts for those biennium and compare each of those to actuals. So, for example, here, this is the degree to which actuals came in relative to each of those potential numbers. So, for 8183, just for example, if you had a very naive forecast going into 8183 of 13.5%, actuals would have come in roughly 2 to 3% below that. In fact, they came in, relative to the close of session forecast, closer to 7% below. So what that's saying is that the close of session forecast going into that biennium was a little more optimistic than a simple little 13.5% growth rate would have been. And they obviously had reasons. And in fact, the recession hit there in the middle of that biennium. So it's something that they didn't see coming explicitly. What you can see here is at least in the last decade that the forecast has been at least performing considerably better than, say, a naive trend would. And here is a good place to bring up actually a range. This has come up as an issue. Can we provide a range? We have a baseline number. We think revenues could come in above or below that. But do we have a good idea of what the range of that potential dollar value is? And in looking at least at this history, say one standard deviation, statistically speaking, roughly 70% of the time you'll be between one standard deviation above or below the mean, and in fact that's about 7.5% over this period. So that's saying that in general 75% of the time, 70 biennia out of 100 if you want to live that long, that you will come in between 7.5% above and below the close of session forecast. Now that's assuming here that these two decades somehow are representative of all decades, but it's a good starting place from which to talk. Now, one of the questions looking there is, why doesn't the close of session forecast always beat a naive trend? You've got more information than obviously is embodied in that average. And what I want to look at now is actually some of the data issues surrounding the forecast. And this here, for example, just looks at the data we had available going into this last December forecast. What did we have upon which we established our forecast? And first and foremost, we had tax collections through October of 2002. And that seems like, well, that's fairly current information. And in fact, if you look at the volatility of personal income tax receipts, that may or may not be a good thing, having this recent data, because there can be enough volatility there, because there are a number of factors actually going into changes from quarter to quarter in personal income tax. And this is actually a quarter over the year-ago quarter, so seasonality is not in here. This is literally the volatility from one year to the next of the exact same quarter. And so you can have, say, changes in that that aren't necessarily representative of the underlying trend in general fund revenues. And so it's recent data, and it's potentially helpful, but it can also be misleading, as in fact, if you look at what we saw for the fourth quarter of calendar year 2001, we had a major spike up from what looked to be that, what we thought was temporary weakness. And that was actually one of the reasons why the March forecast 2002 wasn't down much at all, because the inclination there was that we had seen the blip we were experiencing, and now we were coming back to bottom and we're going to come out of that. Instead, you can see what happened. So there's issues there around what exactly you're getting by that recent information. In addition to that, at that time, we had personal and corporate tax return information from the Department of Revenue for tax year 2000. And in fact, that's still our latest look. So in terms of understanding the components of income and what's driving liability, tax year 2000 is still our best understanding of the issue. So you can see the lag there in terms of knowing, well, what did happen in 2001 and 2002. We still don't have all of the information that would allow us to say exactly what has happened. We have a lot of sample data and a lot of ideas, but in terms of conclusively knowing what drove this drop, we're still kind of on an estimated basis. In addition, we had personal income data for 2000. We had more recent estimates, but those can be subject to major revision over time. 2000 was the last number that basically will not change from here on out. And just to give an example of that, between September 2002 and December 2002, those two forecasts, the Oregon personal income projection for 2001 dropped $1 billion, which now is very consistent with what we're seeing, but that's how much later we actually got conclusive evidence for why did everything drop out in 2001-2002. Employment data we have for basically a year later, but it tends to be less correlated with general fund revenues than, say, personal income would be. And what the point here is that what's going on in the economy at this point in time is not necessarily apparent in the information you have at the time you're making the forecast. You tend to be operating behind yourself, and what that makes most difficult is getting to these turning points. When things change, you tend not to see them until you've basically flown by them.
So, Michael, is there ways to build the budget? And I think it was Duncan Wise from the Business Council that put this idea forward, to build the budget in increments. Is that a more effective way to do it, where you have your forecast, and then 6 months out, you've built a budget conservatively, and then 6 months out into the new biennium, as you see revenue coming in, you are able to just spend, so you build your budgets, I guess, in increments to deal with some of the fact that we're just behind the schedule, and you're just perhaps never going to be able to re-sharp declines like we just experienced. So I don't know if other states do that. It certainly seemed like an intriguing idea that you would build a base budget on a conservative estimate, and then 666, you would augment that budget as revenues come in.
Mr. Chair, that's the first of that particular type of budgeting methodology that I've heard. Others that come up are on a fiscal year basis. Do you do better because you don't project that second year out from so far behind? I mean, these issues have come up.
Senator Hannon, do you have, what do you think of that notion that you would?
I was just trying to think about what you were talking about there, Mr. Chairman, and it's real interesting because I'd never thought about it quite in that context. Because when you apply it, it raises the question how much diversity is going to be built into the numbers as you try to assemble those kind of documents. In Ways and Means, it's hard to project budgets with the idea that there may be a roller coaster out here somewhere. So you build cushions in with the assumption, and I'm not sure if you could do that with revenue forecasting. If I make myself clear where I'm coming from, you would be cushioning all the time, it would appear to me.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannan, I guess I see that the forecast wouldn't change at all. I mean, we give a quarterly update, and when we see conditions have changed, we incorporate that in, we come up with our new forecast numbers. The option here that I see is really almost strictly on the budget side.
Well, yeah, it would also
it is budget.
It would also be on the forecast side. You would be able to, under at least the intriguing part to me is you would provide the forecast, but also a rosy and a conservative. And our first budget would be based on at least in a more conservative mean area. And then as revenues 6 months out, as we start to get into the biennium, as revenues come in, we would have built into that budget, not through e-board or special sessions, but we would have built into additional expenditures based on where we're headed into the biennium. Just the two problems it solves is, one, it gets you out of what we just went through with the five special sessions.
Mm.
Yeah, that's true. Not necessarily, but it helps with that. To me, it sounded, and I don't know if it works with the forecasting model that y'all have, if that would be a possibility to have, give us some sort of a range, and then you build your priority budget and what you can purchase down the road based on revenues that are coming in.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me follow that up with a different twist, and it was something that I heard proposed in one of our caucus meetings yesterday, and it was a Washington model where they have these economic advisors over here and they get that high and low figure and then they try to guesstimate in between to give a conservative revenue approach. And there's some idea or suggestion that we might want to look at incorporating some of those proposed suggestions in the Oregon plan because they showed some graphs of where the predictions went and where the actual revenue went. They almost tailored each other. And it was based upon revenue coming in versus expenditures going out. And that's following up on your approach there. Your approach, Mr. Chairman, is more budget. I think Tom is accurate. Whereas his problem is projecting revenue, or his difficulty is projecting revenue.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannan, there would not be a problem with us from what we think is our most likely forecast to occur, and then give a either want to call it optimistic, pessimistic, mm-hmm. or high, low, that we think is in a reasonable range of possibility that could occur, and provide that information. And then I see on the legislators' part, they can take a look at that and say, well, if this is what you think is your best guess and this is the low range here, for budgetary purposes, then possibly you want to budget towards the lower range and keep an amount as an ending balance. Because then if it turns out that the forecast turned out to be too optimistic, you had something to work with, rather than being in a situation where you're definitely short of funds and need to find them someplace.
Mr. Chairman, if I could add it. Just on that chart that's on the memo that I have, there's the forecast history. And this forecast is under close of session, but that's the first time that's happened since 81-83. So I think there's been a built-in expectation that we're going to have more revenue than projected, and I think that's influenced the budgetary decision process, and especially in recent years.
Well, the question it begs is it more likely to have a high projection and they're thus by kicking the kicker all the time? That's the question it begs. So if you get it down to a more realistic figure, whereas that kicker is not kicking all the time.
Mr. Chair, but they do a pretty good job when you get, I mean, 2%.
Well, I know, but it's like tying two hands behind your back and say, go out and fight the world, too. That's pretty damn good for mm-hmm. what they do.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Henn, if you just look at that 2% versus what we're calling is about a 7.5% variability for the most part, right there you see the contradiction. You're going to be likely to kick that 2% number more often than not, barring even any predilection to being conservative in the forecast. Mm-hmm. And over that two-decade period, the forecast has averaged now with both 81, 83 in it and this current biennium, about 1.6% above. Mm-hmm. So there is definitely evidence there for a certain degree of conservatism.
Mm-hmm. And yet there is, those last two biennia, the forecast was in within 2%, yet we had kickers both times because of the mechanics of the calculation. You did the personal and corporate separate. But when you combine the two, they were within 2%.
Should we change the date?
Well, one of the things
from kicking even within the 2%.
Well,
because you use the close of session,
mm-hmm. 26 months versus something closer. Than
that 26. Well, certainly that would reduce the chances of the kicker. But even the inclusion of corporate into a single calculation, so you just make one calculation on general fund and then allocate a credit to corporate and personal based on shares, you'd have the kicker going less because corporate is so random and variable that it becomes a law of large numbers that it becomes offsetting errors. And that's indeed what's happened. The two biennia prior to this the current downturn, corporate was under forecast substantially both biennia, yet personal was a bust. So you end up paying a kicker based on that, and corporate reduces your revenue. So your net revenue gain is less than 2%.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, mentioning about the turning points that are very hard to forecast, just want to mention that we really have gone through some very unusual economic times. The 1990s expansion that we just went through, that's the longest that we've had since records have been kept since the end of the Civil War. The stock market never before went to gain 20% for three consecutive years, first time in its history. Y2K was an event that it's the first and only event that we'll have like that. I think in the next 1,000 years we'll probably figure out how to fix that particular problem. In the meantime, though, it most likely caused a bunching up of investments. And especially for Oregon, that helped us because that's where we have a comparative advantage. So that business fixed investments was the highest percentage of gross domestic product in history in the year 2000. Likewise, with that bunching up, it also came down quite rapidly, too. And we felt this recession hurt us a little bit more. Give some idea of the data that on what Michael was talking about, but looking at our employment situation, what this graph is looking at is what information did we have available to us when we made the May 2001 forecast for this budget period compared to now the revisions in those data that we now have to date. So the blue here is the information we had available. And as you can see, up to the point and up to the last quarter that we had employment information before making the May 2001 forecast, we saw things slowing down. Most economists thought we were going to dodge the recession bullet, and we had lowered the forecast and also the revenue forecast, but undoubtedly, in retrospect, of course, not low enough. Consequently, now the data has been revised. We see that indeed, rather than having a positive 0.8% annualized growth in that first quarter of 2001, it was actually declining at a rate of 1.1%. And this just makes some of the difficulty of forecasting, given the information and the data that would be more reflective of what actually is happening once they get better information in, is reported and revised. Now, we're also not saying that, you know, woe is us, you know, this is just, you know, this is a tough job of forecasting. We want to be proactive on this. So one of the things that we're presently doing is trying to build a leading economic indicator for the state. To give us more information, another tool, so that if we see conflicting things, we see, like, for example, in this period of time, if this is positive, but our leading economic indicator is saying things are going down, that's a cautionary note then, possibly, to us that we need to look a little bit more closely at what's happening. So that's one of the approaches we're thinking of, you know, trying to be proactive on this, of fighting some of the normal problems that forecasters face.
Now I'd like to just review the December revenue forecast and discuss some of the issues that we've heard regarding that. So just in terms of numbers, the current biennium now stands at $9.2 billion. And for next biennium, we're looking at $10.9 billion. And as you can see, then growth thereafter. Just to put it in percent change context, you can see the history, which is similar to the graph we saw before, but then with the next three biennium projections also laid out there. And so for 2003-2005, we're projecting revenue to grow over this biennium by 13.6%, which is roughly in line with historical average. And obviously there are some issues there. What I want to look at is, why does our forecast look like that? What are the underlying drivers that are still leading us to make those projections? One thing to note here is that, in fact, this 13.6%, we need to recognize that that is off a very suppressed biennium. I mean, this is the first biennium in two decades that has actually been negative. This is extremely suppressed economic conditions. And so the 13.6% off that is really just saying we get back to normal and we grow maybe 7%, which is fairly low in the context of history. So it's not as aggressive as it actually looks from that perspective. And in reality, as we'll see in a few graphs from here, the whole trend outward is really based on that very suppressed level.
Mr. Chairman.
Uh-huh.
When you put 13.6% growth, is that optimum? And the reason I'm going to ask this question is, before the meeting, I was asking you about a few questions about, is the economy starting to flatten out? And you said, well, yes and no.
That's an economist answer.
Yeah. And I look at that minus 7%, and then you show a rebound of 13.6. The president's State of the Union speech, I think his budget is projecting a 4% growth rate. I'm not sure. I think that was the figure that was used in the speech the other night, was a 4% growth rate. And if we're looking at a 13% recovery, then should we lower our expectations down from 13.6%? Because if we're still down at the minus 7 and bounce back up to the 13.6, are we really going to shoot a figure somewhere lower than that? And are we going to get ourselves in a position of saying, well, we'll appropriate money based upon a 13.6 figure, but then we have five special sessions because we're not recovering as fast as expectations led us to believe. In other words, this is not a normal time of recovery. This is abnormal. We're in an abnormal low, and we may not be in a normal recovery.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, let's go forward to the next couple of graphs to get under what are the economic forecasts driving this, see what those look like. And just to give more introspection into exactly how this relates to the economic forecast,
okay,
and then redress.
Okay.
And you've just basically taken my first bullet with the rebound. One of the issues here is business investment. Obviously, we had a significant run-up and a compression of business investment that then dropped off. Basically, if you've replaced everything in the span of 3 years, you're going to take some time off and not have to replace things, but eventually you're going to have to. If the average rule of thumb of 5 years or so average replacement time on business equipment it still holds, which it should, then all of that investment done between about 96 and 2000 should then come up for replacement again starting 03, 04, 05, 06. And so you are looking at the potential here for an echo of that boom in the late 90s. That's one issue that's sitting out there that could potentially fuel a comeback for our economy. Not nearly as large as that one, but it is out there as a potential upside risk. Now, the personal income forecast from the economic model feeds into the revenue forecast, and this is the December forecast. As you can see, down to a low of 2.5% and returning gradually. And one thing I like to remember is that, in fact, this next biennium has not started yet. It's a good 5 months away, and the end of it's a good 29 months away. And in economic terms, that's a long, long time. A lot can change, and in fact, the recovery should be well into swing starting next year. And so you're looking at fairly decent conditions for most of next biennium. Now, an average of 6.1%, we're looking there over 03 to 05 calendar years of maybe an average somewhere below that. We have to remember that we're talking about a two-year period, so you actually compound that annual rate times two. I think that might be one of the issues with the 4% number, is that it might be a one-year growth rate and not a two-year, so those two seem more disparate than they actually are. But that still, that doesn't get you back to the 13.6. A couple of other issues remain. That personal income measure doesn't include a number of income sources that are in taxable income. And what's been going on, at least in the past two decades, is that those components have actually been growing faster than overall gross income, particularly capital gains, as we know, but also retirement income, and which should continue to do so as the baby boomers reach retirement age, which they are just starting to do and will do so now for the next two decades. So there's issues there where actually the growth in taxable income should exceed the growth in personal income.
Mr. Chairman, How close an observation are you of the stock market mutual funds? Because the baby boomers are going to probably have to work 5 to 6 or 10 years longer, because their proceeds and their retirement accounts, you know, 401ks and everything else, have taken a substantial hit in the last 2 years. So when you show the spikes up there in 97, 98, 99 and there, and 85, you better go on out the next graph that shows you 2003, that shows you the dropping off below your scale. So capital gains during that period, that's the reason, you know, you got a president that's offering capital gains tax reduction right now, because there is no capital gains. I mean, who's kidding who? Zero, zero is zero.
You had to bring up PERS.
And so retirement income outpaced gross income growth? Not true. Not the last year and a half.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, that will be one of the interesting things to see as we get the 2001 data in from the tax returns. What we do know is that the capital gains figure obviously dropped by more than half, about 54% in 2001. Retirement income didn't change. Now, that's a preliminary number, and we haven't given as much thought to that because it was not nearly the driver in this swing as the capital gains, but it is something that's going to get our focus going forward.
But Senator Hammond, also, you're right in terms of the capital gains, and everybody's debating whether we're ever going to see the market come back or is it just going to stay down for a long time. But, you know, in terms of these 0305 numbers, one of the positives in a very negative way, it's a positive, is the capital gains fell so much this year, this biennium, that they can't fall much further next biennium. So you're not going to have another big percentage decline in that category. So that's, when you're looking at those numbers, you're coming off of a very low level.
That's true. I think that that's why the argument to cut capital gains now, why they're down, rather than cut them when they're up. Nobody wants to cut them when they're up because that's revenues coming into the tax coffers. And so they want to cut them when they're down. But I'm not sure how much lower they might possibly go also.
Well, I'm glad Senator Deckard wasn't in here to hear this discussion of capital gains cuts.
Why, are we having problems over there?
Yeah, he wants.
Oh.
Senator Hannon, and if I can go back a second, our capital gains forecast, which now is an explicit component of our liability forecast, we don't have capital gains coming back to anything like historical levels in the entire forecast horizon. Matter of fact, we have an additional drop in 2002, basically 2003 mirroring 2001, and only even return to 2001 or above 2001 levels out halfway through next biennium. So there really is no driving from capital gains, at least in that. If capital gains, we thought, if we were somehow really optimistic, our forecast would be much higher, actually.
Are you going to be able to... Can I continue, Mr. Chairman? Are you going to be able to show us a projected corporate growth or what is projected out? Because when you showed the personal income growth, it was at 13%. What are you projecting the corporate growth to be?
Senator Hannon, that was general fund revenues in total.
General fund revenues. So what do you base that upon? Personal income growth, corporate growth, or a combination of both?
It is personal income that is driving that entire forecast. Our corporate income tax forecast grows hardly at all for the next few years, in particular due to a number of law changes.
Okay.
The bonus depreciation, but as well as the apportionment change that kicks in here in tax year 2003. I mean, there's another number of reasons why we don't expect corporate to do much at all in the next few biennium.
Even with the tax change of not taxing dividends, I was hearing that that's going to change. It's going to put pressure on the behavior of corporations to issue dividends now that they won't be taxed, instead of reinvesting it. But I don't know how significant that is to your projections.
Senator Cochran? It appears, I've seen both now. Microsoft gave us a surprise of saying that they were going to be paying dividends. But definitely the semiconductor industry just sort of said, we don't see any change at all. We think we're still kind of growth-type industries, and it's the appreciation of the price that our investors want. And that's what we'd rather do and reinvest the amount. So I think it goes across the board. I think you'll find that you may see some of your more traditional firms that don't already offer dividends may decide to do so. But it appears quite a bit of the high-tech, Microsoft being an exception here, pretty much will stay the way they've been doing it.
And it's a question of whether they can get, whether Bush can get that passed.
Yeah.
That way.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. We're ranging far and wide without any chairs here. This is pretty good.
Yeah,
I like this.
Good,
yeah.
Good,
have these guys over for a beer and just.
one last element to this is the effective tax rate. We've said personal income will grow X amount. We expect taxable income maybe to exceed that for a variety of reasons. And then as well, liability will grow even faster than that because historically, as we've had bracket creep, the effective tax rate on those dollars has climbed, albeit slowly, but it is still incrementing up as we go forward. Again, the data end in 2000. It will be interesting to see what happens here in 2001. But the issue is, as we go forward in time, there are a number of factors that combine to make that number seem not so aggressive. The final graph here makes a few assumptions, but what we basically said was we know the late 90s were aberrant. So let's go back before there and ask ourselves, okay, what did the economy and what did general fund revenues look like prior to that? And growth was, depending on which end and begin points you want to pick, was somewhere between 7 and 8%. So we said, okay, let's take 7%, the low end there, and start with a pre-boom level of personal income tax and just say, what does that look like if you just trend that out? And obviously you can see the run-up there relative to that in the late 90s. And our forecast does not come back to that level, and in fact it never actually reaches that level. It approaches it out in about 2006 and then falls off a little for a number of issues.
Mr. Chairman, is there an indication, have you done any analysis on what the proposed moving of the dates of the federal tax, like the marriage penalty, children deduction, and if that would drive that up, down, or maybe steady even as far as personal income tax growth in Oregon, because you're projecting that historical trend, that's how history has gone, but all of a sudden if we get a spike because of the federal change, have you done any pre-analysis where that might impact that rather than your historical trend going up?
Senator Hanna, we're looking at that now, and Elizabeth's working on that. What we're waiting for is to get a good markup from the Joint Committee on Taxation. And, you know, they operate just like we do.
Yeah.
They haven't gotten a precise bill to look at. Our understanding is there's some real implementation questions around the dividend exclusion, you know, how that would work in actual law, because the proposal is to prevent double taxation, which means there would be taxation at the corporate level before it became dividends. And how you track that through and make sure of that, you know, a lot of tax practitioners are saying, well, how would that be written and how would that work? It couldn't possibly be all the dividends. So that would clearly be a negative for us. But some of the others are positive. Whenever the federal government lowers its rates or increases its credits, like the child credit, and the president's calling for a moving up of those rate reductions,
it raises ours.
It increases ours.
That's
an offsetting effect.
That's why I'm asking is that I'd like to have some comparisons, Paul. So as we start talking about when do we connect, how do we stay connected, when do we disconnect, we have some forethought on having predication on if the feds move to this level. I mean, we could really be bankrolling some additional windfall taxes to the state if the feds were to implement some of these things. Because while they're getting federal tax relief, their state income tax is going up.
Mr. Chair, or Senator, when you know, one of the largest kickers we had was in 95-97.
Yeah.
And one of the factors that contributed over $100 million to that, in my estimation at the time, was the reduction in federal capital gains taxes. Because the feds reduced it, and people wanted to take advantage of that at the federal level. The federal tax is much higher. Well, when they did that, of course, they kicked over 9% to the Department of Revenue to pay state taxes. So we were just kind of the outside beneficiary of that. So you're right,
We could be
a beneficiary, or in the case of bonus depreciation, we lost revenue. So, I mean, it's a major factor. But also remember that on your work plan, that's one of your major topics is the connection to the federal code. What kind of proposal we get? We've got to look at inheritance tax. We've got to look at.
Now you mentioned some of the previous laws. You mentioned something else, Paul. If the dividend is not taxed twice and is paid for by the corporation, would that also serve to drive our corporate income tax rate up? Because part of that is a deductibility of saying to a corporation, if you pay, you get to deduct. Now, if all of a sudden they're going to pay, without the deduction, mm-hmm. how is that going to translate into revenue?
Well, right now, their dividends, whatever they send out as dividends, is taxed as corporate income. So I mean, that's the double taxation idea.
Okay.
They got to pay a tax on it at the corporate level. And then if you get it as a dividend, you as an individual, then you got to pay it again on the personal tax. So where the reduction would come would be at the individual level. Now, what that does in terms of corporate behavior, you know, it could have a number of ramifications. It could encourage them to send out more dividends, but they would still have to report it as a profit initially.
Okay.
And you're going to net those federal changes out for us. I mean, you're going to show us each one. And
Senator, we just took a very cursory look at the dividend exclusion. We know there's about $100 million in our latest data on what's Oregon income tax collections from dividends total. But, you know, as I say, implementing that, I think everybody, including Department of Revenue, doubts they would be able to capture all of that. Mm-hmm. So it's something less than $100 million, but that would be an outside maximum amount, again, offset by some of the increased revenue you would get from the lower federal rates.
Right. Okay.
That actually concludes our presentation here.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may, I'm going to step down below.
Oh, you're up.
I'm up next.
Oh, boy, we have our legislative rep. So I'm trying to remember, what was the one question that I did, the big one that I had for y'all before I... Well, I forgot it. I had one float. And then
if you're already forgetting things at your age, you're in trouble.
Thank you very much.
Did you have any?
Just here to help.
Not very often, but sometimes that is the case. Officer Warner, we're pleased to have you before our committee.
This doesn't show up real well, but you do have this in front of you as an outline. As I said earlier, given the particularly the forecast declines in June and September and the consequent special sessions from there, after that, our interim House chair, Chair Shetterly, directed me to review the forecast, review what's happened over the last year and a half, and make some recommendations, some technical recommendations, which I have some here, and possibly some structural and reporting changes. And I want to go through those with you. The memo there is kind of talks about in detail some of those, what I'm going to talk about here in this outline. But what I'm going to do is walk through these four basic components, which would be the review of the current forecast compared to the close of session, the strengths of the current system, and I think there are a number of them, and some of the technical changes, and a number of which Tom and Michael have talked about and are really implementing, and also some structural changes which would require legislation. And we did go through this exercise this morning with the House Revenue Committee, and basically the chair directed me to begin drafting legislation on some of these proposed changes. So you may see them in bill form as well. In terms of the difference between the close of session and the current forecast, it was very instructive for me to walk back to that May 2001 forecast, to look at the underlying economic assumptions and numbers for that, and try to explain the $2.03 billion reduction that's taken place in general fund revenue between May of 2001 and December of 2002. You're looking at about a $1.9 billion reduction in the resource estimate, but remember you added about $150 million in special session actions, primarily through the phase in of Measure 88. So it would have been a little over two billion without your actions. So I tried to look back on basically the economic model and the numbers that come from that to try to trace back an explanation of it. The first thing I did was look at the calendar year numbers for 2001 and 2002 for wage and salary income. That's, of course, made up of employment and wages. So that's how that number is derived. There's a wage rate projection, and there's a wage and salary employment projection. The combination of those two becomes wage and salary income. That's about 60% of your tax base, 60% of adjusted gross income. Well, if you look at those 2 years in December versus last May of 01, you get a difference of $10.6 billion. So that forecast has come down $10.6 billion. So that gets you an idea of the decrease there in the primary component of the base. Now, employment itself is down considerably less than that. Employment is down by 2.6%. So a lot of it is in the wage component. But the wage component, these are less hours worked. Bonus income that Tom has talked about as a source of volatility, particularly in the tech sector. All of those components in which the state is picking up revenue from. That $10.6 billion, I assume the tax rate of 7% as an estimated marginal effective tax rate. If you do that, you would come up with $742 million. In other words, if those May forecasts on wage and salary income would have held true, we'd have $742 million in this biennium's budget. So it's over a third of the explanation for the $2 billion shortfall is in the wage and salary component. And you'll see when I come back, one of the technical recommendations is basically to try to develop that wage sector more and try to disaggregate it more and get a better sense of what's going on, particularly in the tech sector and some of the other manufacturing sectors.
Paul, do you happen to have on the wage and salary the amount of people that lost their wages in so-called family wage jobs versus those that lost their wages due to minimum wage? As an example, the unemployment rate, does it ever reflect a disparity between wage earners to show that there were more high income, modest income, low income people are being put on the unemployment rolls?
Senator, those two numbers are really derived at very differently, and I think that's part of the things that makes it hard to interpret the data. You know, the unemployment rate is based on a national household survey. The Bureau of Labor Statistics calls people up and asks, "Are you looking for a job? Did you work in the last week?" And if you say no, if you say you're looking for a job and you didn't work, you're counted as unemployed. Oregon is not a big enough part of that sample. We've got 10 states that are, but Oregon, of course, isn't one of them. So we've got to go through some statistical gyrations that the Employment Department does using back to census data, and they have some various steps. And some of that makes that data somewhat unreliable. But it's really
looking. What I'm going to ask is how reliable is that?
We think that's a tricky data source. Now, if it starts to rise as it has over the last 2 years on a consistent basis, clearly it's indicating economic hardship. But if we look at the data here in terms of wage and salary income, that's just all wages and salaries. I mean, that's everything. It would include people that have two jobs, in which there are about 5% of jobs are filled by somebody else that has another job. One of the sectors I remember that's caused a lot of confusion and recessions is the real estate sector. Real estate employment doesn't drop very much, but salaries drop through the floor because you're not carrying out much real estate activity. That's not so true in this recession, but many recessions that's been the case. So there are certain types of occupations like that. People continue to work, but they don't get any income. Well, of course, on the tax side, that's where the state loses revenue, even though it's not showing up in our unemployment rates.
I see. Okay.
So there's that kind of difference. But in terms of this wage and salary income, of course, remember from the state standpoint, we're looking at this strictly from a revenue standpoint, we're going to lose a lot more if it's a high-income, high-tech worker all at the 9% rate than we are if somebody's making $20,000 a year and they get laid off. Well, all that's being taxed at a lower rate. So we'll lose more from those high-end people when they lose bonus or other types of wage income. The second component is on the corporate income, and there are really three elements to this. Corporate income is down $464 million, or about a quarter of your reduction in revenue. The variable that has always been used to try to describe corporate income is the National Corporate Profits Forecast, and that comes from the National Forecasting Service. Most of your corporate income, I think you still have one more orientation, that's on your corporate income tax, and that'll be next week. But Elizabeth has some numbers showing relatively small number of corporations pay most of the taxes, and they're big national corporations. So it's national profits that influence our base. And those national profits in the national forecast is down 54% for the 2 years, May 01 versus December of 02. So the national numbers, I think this back to one of your questions earlier, Senator, on the national versus state. Well, here's where we're using a national forecast because it's going to reflect our corporate income. It's down over half. And that's a big reason for the decrease in corporate revenue. That accounts, if you assume Oregon's a little over 1% of the total and assume a 6% effective corporate rate, that's about $272 million. So $272 of the $464 can be explained by the national profit forecast. Another element here is the bonus depreciation. A little over $100 million, we think, reduced state revenue through the bonus depreciation. We will get some feedback, as Michael pointed out, in 05, 07, because those assets that were depreciated now won't be depreciated again in the future. They can't be. So some of that's been pulled forward. The other factor is our apportionment formula. You know, if you're calculating a tax for Intel or for Nike or any national, international company, what you do is estimate their national income, the water's edge. What is their total income, total profits? And then you apportion it back to Oregon. Well, the amount we apportion back to Oregon is our three factors, sales, payroll, and property. And with sales now, and these numbers counting for double weight compared to the other two, but one way of getting at that apportionment factor or sales factor would be to look at Oregon's income compared to the U.S. And if you look at the forecast in May of 01 versus December of 02, our income forecast is down 4.8%. The U.S. is down 0.7%. So that gives you a sense of that relative magnitude that Oregon's clearly been hit harder than the national economy in terms of the recession. And I think that would be showing up in the apportionment formula through lower sales to be apportioned back to Oregon. Hmm. So at least it would be a reflection of that. So I think those three elements explain the corporate reduction, the lower national profits, the bonus depreciation at the federal level that affected Oregon, plus the lower sales apportioned back to Oregon because we've been hit harder by the recession. The third component you're very familiar with is the capital gains. I think it was 95 when I pulled capital gains out and began estimating that separately because it began to grow as such a revenue source. But it is not in the personal income data, so you have to estimate it separately. And if you look at the forecast that was used in May of 01 versus the December, it's about $4 billion different in capital gains, $4 billion less now. And at 8.5%, most of that's in the top bracket, at 8.5% tax rate, that's $340 million. So that's 17% of the difference. The final component I have is other business and investment income, which is very difficult to try to translate into tax liability because you have subchapter S corporations. You have other components of the tax base that are only indirectly reflected in the income numbers. But if you do look at components that are forecasted of personal income, one is dividends, interest, and rent, reflecting return on financial assets. And the other is non-farm proprietor's income. And compare those two forecasts. The current one now would explain about $203 million less in revenue. So $203 million, about 10% of that $2 billion shortfall. So with those three components, we're able to explain about 87% of the shortfall in the forecast. To me, anyway, that was somewhat comforting in the sense that we can at least walk back to the economic model and see where the problems occurred and what assumptions didn't work. I was concerned we'd have more unexplained decrease there because a lot of states have experienced that. I know I was talking with a forecaster in Idaho this week, and he was talking about
their employment was essentially flat last year, yet their income tax has dropped 18%. So they really were hit, capital gains, of course, being a big piece for them, too. But I think this gives at least some direction in terms of walking back to the economic model and reviewing some of the things that happened. Of that 13% miscellaneous, some of it we know is due to things like lower general fund interest earnings, but it's probably some of it's due to my calculations. One thing I did for wage and salary income, I used 01-02 calendar years, which, as Michael was saying, most of that comes in withholding, so that's probably a bit of an understatement. That number's probably a little bit higher when you count the first 6 months of 03. But that gives you a sense. And so if you walk back through that and kind of summarize the differences now in May of 01, national recession was not anticipated. A slowdown was, a flat economy, but not an actual recession. This is the first time that we've been in recession with the structural change we had in Oregon in the 90s. And a lot of discussion about that. I remember in the 90s as high tech was growing, okay, we're away from the timber economy, we're going to be more stable, less cyclical. Well, that did not turn out to be the case. So we did go through a structural change. I think we learned something in terms of the cyclicality of our economy now that's driven by semiconductors and high tech equipment. We did have this drop in capital gains, which is unprecedented. We did see these highly sensitive components to income, the financial markets, business income, that are taking up a bigger share of adjusted gross income and are likely to make our income tax more volatile in the future. I think what it's reflecting is our system of payment is really more flexible. Wages are more flexible. It means prices are probably more flexible, which is good for the economy, but means our revenue is going to get hit harder during these recessions. In terms of the forecast process itself, just a little bit of history. And the forecast, the state economist position was created as a full-time position in 1980. In response, really, to the forecast of the 70s, there was actually a part-time economist that was hired on a part-time basis. I think he worked for a bank, and he worked on a part-time basis and did the forecast for the executive department. We'd come in, but he didn't have any clear-cut methodology, and there wasn't a lot of confidence in the process, particularly in the 70s, where things were extremely volatile with inflation. We had, you know, general fund revenue growth of 35-40% in a couple of biennia because a lot of it was inflation, but I mean, prices were just exploding and revenue went too. So the idea was to professionalize the forecast process, and that created the state economist position, and Chang Mok San was hired. Chang Mok is now the Washington state economist and has been since 88 or 85, I guess. But the quarterly forecast began in February of 81. We've got a whole file of them. Anybody who wants to look back on some of those old forecasts. They do bear out one of the things that Tom mentioned about data revisions. You look at the personal income that they thought was history, that their initial estimates were, and then you go back 2 years later and it's been revised down about 6 or 7%. So in other words, they were starting from a much higher position than they were really at. They thought they were starting from. So that's one of the real problems they had at that time. In terms of the process that Michael went through, the basic schematics, that stayed the same since 81. I mean, that basic format is still there. But the system, I think, clearly has some strengths, and I've kind of tried to lay these out here. And if you look at kind of the four of them that I put down, one of the first things that Chang Mok San did was to develop the state's economic model. He had assistance from DRI, which is now Global Insight, so we still have that basic connection there. That, I think, is a strength of the system. All states have that link. It gives you a basis, a consensus, credible national forecast that's updated on a regular basis every month. So you have current information. And the national economy explains just about all of Oregon's fluctuations. Not the amplitude as much, but the direction.
very seldom in our history, I don't know of a time when we've actually declined when the national economy wasn't in recession. So, I mean, we're going to follow the national business cycle. It's always a question of, you know, how far down and how far up, but we'll be moving with the U.S. The second strength in the system is the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors that was created as by executive order by Governor Attia in 1981. And that still, as Tom showed you on the chart there, the council advises the state economists on the forecast. That remains, I think, a real asset to the system. I've had states, when I was doing this job, asking me about that, and a number of states have created these types of councils. I think they're very beneficial, give you good insight, and it's all on a volunteer basis, and you have really becomes a major source of information and good feedback. The third element of the system is a single forecast system. A lot of states don't have a single forecast system. They have an executive forecast and a legislative forecast. Idaho, for example, California. Washington doesn't, but those states do. I think that causes a lot of confusion, and I think potentially it makes the system more subject to political pressures. And my recommendation is to maintain that strength of the system. I think would be an important thing to maintain. The fourth is the quarterly updates. The quarterly updates are cited by bond rating agencies as a strength of our system. They're regular. People know when they're going to occur. There's not, we maybe should do no forecast now because, you know, we don't like the numbers now. It's all done on a regular basis, and I think that really helps with credibility and planning.
Paul, on those, the states that have the legislative and executive forecast systems, do they develop two? Is it similar to Congress where you're always quibbling over the numbers and almost you have two budgets?
It certainly potentially can be that way. I think there's been some of that in California. I know Idaho, you know, there's a timing thing in Idaho. Basically, the Department of Financial Management, I think it is, DFM, Division of Financial Management, they will develop a forecast consistent with the governor's proposal, you know, like we do here. But then it would be comparable to us developing a separate forecast in May to be used for the budget. And they'll be different just because the timing is going to make a difference. But, you know, some of that there can be cooperation informally in those kind of systems, or there can be antagonism. Yeah. But I think you're creating the possibility for confusion by that kind of system. Mm-hmm. And also there's a basic efficiency issue, too. You want to create two separate structures and have expertise in doing the same thing. So in terms of the recommended changes, these, I'll go through the technical ones quickly because I think largely they are being implemented. We use a sample for the personal income tax model. That's being updated at 2000. And again, you can see one of the problems here. That's the latest complete data we have, as Michael said, but 2000 was hardly a typical year. I mean, that was the peak of the capital gain. So we've got to keep that in mind as we're looking at that sample. We have increased the sample significantly. And we think it's going to be very useful, especially for high-income taxpayers, where the money comes from. Industry-specific and firm-specific information. Elizabeth showed you some of the withholding numbers coming from the different industry sectors. When I was doing the forecasting, we didn't have that kind of information. In fact, we haven't had it until about the last, year or so, or less. It's the last 6 months or so that that's been available. Department of Revenue's developed that. And you can see by just looking at those charts we had, you can see the cyclical sectors, and you can see manufacturing back in the spring of 2001 beginning to drop off and those withholding payments. It was a good indicator of things to come. And that gives you valuable insight, I think. And even more can be looking at individual firms, individual corporations, especially the bigger taxpayers. Now, we have strict disclosure guidelines that limit any public statements about those, but legislature gave state economists some additional authority as far as looking at those individual returns. We have that authority in legislative revenue that helps us to understand particular proposals and what the implications are, how many companies are affected. So, and that can be very valuable if a couple of your major corporate taxpayers are making small advance payments,
You know, that's telling you something. Or they're getting a huge refund, and you know there's something going on in what sector that's happening in. The other things, Tom mentioned developing a leading indicators index. This has been kind of a background issue for a long time, but having a recession raises that back up to prominence, and I think it's something that could be very valuable in helping us with turning points where economists always have trouble. We are, you know, our tax base is adjusted gross income and adjustments from that. And so, you know, we have to walk from the economic model, which has a different measure of income, to the taxable measure. And so we've done that in various kind of indirect ways, but that's something that could be fleshed out. Look at some of the issues in terms of capital gains or pension income or other types of business income, subchapter S income, partnerships, and so forth, that would give us some sense, because it tends to be the components that are not in personal income that are in taxable income are very volatile.
So would you structurally model that, or how would...
I think you can develop a set of transition equations that would walk from personal income to adjusted gross income. So you'd be making formal projections of the components of adjusted gross income, whereas now we're kind of doing a top-level projection.
And that's not that's not statutory. That's just... You just develop the model and start utilizing it.
Well, it's easier. It can be in terms of the accuracy. I mean, because we don't... Some of that data, you know, is affected by tax law changes and everything else. So you've got to anticipate those kinds of things as well as the underlying economic variables. I mentioned the wage rate forecasts, where we saw that wage and salary income, a significant variation there. Some disaggregation, I think, they could be real helpful. And finally, the office has produced a methodology review on a regular basis, on an irregular basis, I should say, and just a recommendation to go to an annual basis. So that's there, up to date, and available to those who want to see it, and may provide some valuable feedback. So those are kind of technical recommendations, none of which require any action really on the legislature's part. The recommended structural reporting changes would require some legislative action, particularly the first one, which I've identified as establishing a revenue forecast board. The idea is that under a single forecast system, legislative and executive branches are joint users of that information, of that forecast. So that gives us consistency there. And the idea would be to go back to beginning end in terms of the appointing authority for the state economist, and get some legislative buy-in to that. I've talked with counsel. A board cannot consist of legislative and executive branch members and have any decision-making authority. That's unconstitutional. So, or at least they would have constitutional concerns about that. So what I'm suggesting here is a board that's appointed by legislative and executive branch leadership. The governor would appoint a member. The treasurer, Senate president, and the speaker would appoint a four-member board who would make recommendations to the governor for appointment to state economist position. And that would the governor would have the ultimate say as the appointing authority. He could reject that recommendation, but then the board would recommend somebody.
Do you worry that that might politicize? I mean, I guess the first thing is what's broken.
Well, I think the concern is that the idea that it would put the political side of on equal footing.
The legislative.
So there would be both a legislative and executive appointment authority, indirect authority.
But, Mr. Chair, doesn't that destroy the notion of rational economics? I mean, why would you let the legislature, I mean, have that capacity? Because, you know, I don't suppose there are really right-wing and left-wing economists on one level, but, you know, there's partisan economists. It just seems, I don't understand what that fixes, bringing in the legislators.
Well, it doesn't bring the legislators in directly. It would bring in a board that would be appointed. I guess my vision of the board would be there may be more conservative or liberal economists, and there indeed are in the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. And that's what I would see would be appointment of well-known economists that would make the recommendation as to the appointment for that position.
Mr. Chair, I could almost see that it would be more advantageous to have one position agreed upon by
the Senate President and the Speaker to, I mean, if it's a mixed, I mean, I suppose you could have very conservative members of both that we've had like for the last 8 years, and then you'd still end up with a conservative. But it would seem to me that anything that would get us towards objectivity, as hard as that is to, you know, to achieve in a, you know, the political world, would be what would be to our benefit.
Well, that's Senator. That's the direction, is that to create. I don't think objectivity has been a problem, but this would help affirm that appearance of objectivity, because there's a joint appointment. You've got joint usage of this product, and you have joint appointment at the other end. Mm-hmm. So there's some joint buy-in at both ends. The other issue that I would see the board ensuring would be a when a forecast is completed, that the appointing authority of the four board members would receive that information simultaneously. And that's where I think there has been a problem, particularly in the special sessions, a sense that this is where I think the House chair has been as well, that there's a problem with perception that some people have the information, others don't. And that, I think, has created a perception problem in terms of the forecast process, not the forecast numbers, but the forecast process and release.
Well, Mr. Chair, as a person that's, you know, probably as biased as you can get, and you know, in my job as a union representative and watching this over time, and you know, my anger at the beneficiaries of the kicker, it makes, I mean, I've had it explained to me why they have to make conservative estimates, and I don't think it's politicized. You know, I think it makes perfect sense to be conservative on that, because to miss it on the other end is to create five special sessions.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, that was not missed because of an optimistic view. It was missed because of circumstances beyond our control. So I don't know where that perception comes from. I mean, I get my blood boiling more reading the, you know, last Sunday's Register Guard with their five economists, and having, you know, Connerly, who I think is probably the, you know, the least objective of all of them, having that place there. When it used to be Margaret Halleck and Connerly, then I could tolerate Connerly. Now there's no Margaret Halleck there, you know. So
She's
I'll shut up now.
She's right down the hall here.
I know. In a different capacity.
But Mr. Chair, that would be the function of the board, so it would not be an active decision-making board, only in terms of appointing authority to ensure that a choice for the position when it comes open would be made on a joint basis, and to ensure that we get the release of the information done. This would not be it would be to give Tom, you know, an umbrella in which he could distribute that initial forecast, and I think would give him a clearer appointing authority, would be the intent. I have been directed to start to work with council to draft a bill, so you will see something along those lines. The other element in the recommended change here is the creation of a revenue forecast advisory committee. You looked at Tom's tree there on how he was doing the forecast. There's a Council of Economic Advisors who reviews the economic forecast, but there is no review on the revenue forecast side. This would create a committee made up of primarily of probably people within state government, revenue department, for example. Could be tax practitioners that are doing returns, that are aware of what's going in and what kinds of tax law changes there may be. That would look at preliminary revenue numbers and make recommendations. The ultimate decision would rest with the state economist. It has to have a final resting point, an accountability point. But that would give the state economist in the office, I think, another look at those numbers and maybe some insights on what's going on that's not related to the economy, or how those revenue numbers are related to the economic forecast. I do think that given the sensitivity of the revenue numbers, particularly during sessions, that there would need to be an exemption from open meeting laws for that type of committee to be effective.
Don't tell that to our caucus. We can't even have quiet caucuses.
My next two recommendations and for reporting changes, one of the things that happens in this building, as you know, is the we start to get a lot of rumors about, is it up, is it down, how much is it up, how much is it down. The Department of Revenue produces a lot of data. It's all public information, and they have a daily banking report that says how much withholding revenue came in last Thursday. But they also produce a monthly report on receipts on the major taxes, personal, corporate, cigarette, the other taxes they collect. And that's the numbers that the forecast has to balance to. But I don't think it's not widely circulated. Very few people understand that monthly report. And what I'm suggesting here would be basically for Tom to prepare a monthly revenue tracking report for the legislature that would be available to all members. It says, you know, in January this happened to estimated payments and withholding payments. This seems to be tracking above or below our forecast. You know, there may be caveats, seasonal factors, or whatever. But just to give people a sense of how that forecast is tracking, would not be intended to be a new forecast update. There would be no new forecast number. It would just be tracking the most recent data that's coming in and getting, you know, an expert opinion on what it means, what it might mean. Finally, the Office of Economic Analysis, when I first came to it in 1989, basically did the revenue forecast and the economic forecast. That was it. It's added responsibilities over the years, lottery forecasting, which obviously has become an important issue for us. Things like the prison inmate forecast, again, is a key thing. But it's also gotten into some areas, highway cost allocation study. And all I'm suggesting here is that legislative fiscal, when they do their review of the budget, that they review some of those functions and make sure resources are sufficient and they're not taking the key resources away from the primary function, that being the revenue forecast.
And so all of these are in the process of being drafted on the House side.
I would see two bills, or possibly one, the establishment of the Revenue Forecast Board and the Advisory Revenue Forecast Advisory Committee. I think we could get that into one bill.
Into one.
And I'm going to start working with council to draft that. So if the House is inclined to go along, then you may see something down the road dealing with those mm-hmm. suggested changes.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Have you had any conversations with Senator Beyer?
I have not had conversations with Senator Beyer, no.
I believe that there may be some interest in some law along some of these issues.
Okay.
I know Senator Hannon brought up the Washington State model,
mm-hmm.
and I believe Senator Beyer was one that was looking into that. And
okay.
Seems to there's some variation here, but there's some commonality as well there, so might mm-hmm. be worth the discussion.
Okay, I'll do that, Senator. With that, Mr. Chair, I think we're through our agenda.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. And this is Thursday, so we're done.
You are invited as usual on Friday to the House Revenue Committee. They have kind of a similar discussion to what you had Wednesday, but it's the business perspective only. We'll see some of the folks that were here yesterday, but also Duncan Wise, I know Paul Phillips has arranged to have some executives there. So it'll be a broader spectrum, Lynn Lundquist, broader spectrum of the business side, and then they're doing the labor side next Friday.
So that's tomorrow at 8:30.
Tomorrow at
8:30. Finally found a reason to go to Ag and Natural Resources, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
If you have a chance, Paul, to talk to Duncan about that, the idea that he had, I don't think that would need change. We would need a statutory change if that was where you do.
Well, you know, I think the issue is, do you use the baseline forecast? If you use the baseline forecast, and, if you're in a situation where you think that it's too conservative now, for example, then there's nothing that says you have to allocate all of that. I mean, you can leave a projected ending balance.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, you can either spend that next biennium or have a special session and spend it
uh-huh.
in some way, as long as it's still projected to be there.
Uh-huh.
I guess the issue comes in when you know, you think the forecast may be too conservative and you want to spend additional dollars, then you've got that kicker tripwire in there.
Part of the thinking, I mean, number of different levels that you think about it, but in the kicker context, do you need to change it? If you changed it to a, you know, I don't know how that would affect
The kicker statute directs Department of Administrative Services to prepare a forecast, and that forecast becomes the base for the kicker.
It does.
Now, it doesn't say that it can't produce two forecasts, but I think you'd be looking at some, you know, the kicker becomes a very complex issue very quickly. So. And, of course, now it's in the Constitution, so the wording would have to be done very carefully.
Yeah. Something would have to be drafted.
Something would have to be drafted. Now, the language in the Constitution now is that if you decide to override the kicker on a one-term biennium basis, you can do that on a two-thirds vote, and what it says is you make a new estimate.
Oh.
So it's kind of interesting language. That's the language. So you make a new estimate for the base. You know, it's kind of assuming you get more revenue projected, but that's how it's worded. Not that you spend a certain amount, but that you make a new estimate, and then that, so you
so
affect the kicker
that,
that
if you did that, you know, if we did that statutorily, and you did kind of a 1, 2, and 3 on the revenue forecast, and you budgeted appropriate, and then it's just a ways and means decision of budgeting and for the, you know, the mean, and then adding on, which one would apply to the kicker? Would you have to write that in?
I think you'd have to write that in.
Which one is the?
Yes.
Is your kicker number or your?
Right. Yes. There, you know,
that
there are ways.
The Constitution, though, right? The methodology for determining the forecast to determine the kicker didn't get into.
No, it really isn't even in the statute. Statute just says Department of Administrative Services shall prepare a forecast. Doesn't say how it should be done, or
okay,
so that becomes an issue. But you know, it becomes one of the things that becomes very difficult is if there's a perception the forecast is being adjusted because of the kicker or any other extraneous factor, then the credibility factor goes away very quickly.
Yeah.
And given
that's why it's,
you know, the goal is to provide an objective forecast. And once you start to move away from that, I think that becomes very risky, or you perceive to move away from that.
But I mean, under this scenario, it would be because we directed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would be under our direction. I mean, you would have acts, if it went to fruition, you'd have acts of the House, Senate, and the Governor all mm-hmm. saying this is how we would like to. So I think it would inoculate in some respects
mm-hmm.
the office
okay.
To just follow what we directed.
Especially if there was a way to get at the 26-month time out. That's got to be the underlying
mm-hmm.
issue. I mean, it was the underlying issue because of capital gains, obviously, and other stuff in the good times. So.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, that issue is a difficult one because you're really looking at three tax years, basically, because you don't have you don't have all the April 15 returns in from the previous tax year, and you're forecasting out two more. So you really have three tax years there.
So
you don't have a clear idea what liability is.
So anything to say that the forecast shall be actually two forecasts, one 26 months out and one 14 months out, by that 14 months out, you'd probably have at least a closer
sure.
ballpark idea.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate the terminology. Thank you. We're adjourned.